The computers we've come to rely upon for so many things can certainly have an effect on our emotions, even without connecting to the world. Those slowdowns and crashed programs and restart required messages can make us angry or sad or both. It would be great if computers could learn about our emotions. Our guest this hour has spent years working on that very capability, trying to ensure that eventually artificial intelligence will include some emotional intelligence. Rana L. Kaliubi details the quest and a good bit of her own life in a new book called Girl Decoded, A Scientist's Quest to Reclaim Our Humanity by Bringing Emotional Intelligence to Technology. Rana L. Kaliubi is a native Egyptian from Cairo and a computer scientist with a PhD from Cambridge University. She worked on emotion AI at the MIT Media Lab and left there to co-found the company Effectiva. Rana co-hosted a PBS Nova series on AI 2 years ago, so well-versed in broadcasting and her own subject matter. Rana L. Kaliubi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The first vignette in the book is nothing but shocking. I mean, this is a teens watching a man drown. Some people might remember this. What was the larger picture you saw in that situation?
The larger picture is that as we continue to kind of immerse ourselves with interacting with devices, I really think there's an empathy crisis that's going on in our world because a lot of the communication that we do is mediated through technology, but technology is missing out on all of the nuanced nonverbal signals that we send and receive to each other. And so I'm on this journey to bring emotional intelligence into our devices to improve not only human-machine interaction, but also human-to-human communication.
Okay, so I mean, but the approach then is through the machines. I mean, this is what you know. You're a computer scientist, but it sounds like from the first vignette there about watching people drown that the deficit is in people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in this particular story, this is a group of teens who watched a young man drown. But not only did they just watch the man and not help, but they also took their phones out and recorded the video and kind of laughed at the end of it. And that just really strikes me as an extreme case of not having empathy. And we need to consider that and how we are connecting and communicating online. People are just dehumanizing one another. And so my big mantra is we need to humanize technology before it dehumanizes us.
You write of having to consider your own emotional life to be good at this. I mean, what did that circumspection involve?
A lot of decoding myself, but also decoding how humans express emotions. If you look at it, only 10% of how we communicate with one another is in the actual choice of words we use. About 90% is nonverbal, and it's split equally between the facial expressions, the vocal intonations, and the hand gestures we use, and body gestures. So what we're trying to do is use advanced computer vision and machine learning techniques to quantify these signals, to capture them so they're not lost in cyberspace.
Well, it didn't surprise me then to find out that you learned FACS, the facial action coding system. I mean, give us a brief sketch, if you would, of Paul Ekman's work. We have talked about it here before.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so the face is one of the most fascinating canvases for communicating social, emotional, and mental states. And essentially, we have about 45 or so facial muscles, and these move to create a wide gamut of expressions that, of course, express different meanings. For example, the action unit 12, which is the zygomatic muscle, that's, when we pull our lips outwards, that's a smile, right? Or action unit 4 is the corrugator muscle, and that's what you do when you pull your eyebrows together in anger or confusion. So to become a certified FACS coder, it takes you about 100 hours of training, then you have to pass the test, and essentially, you would then be able to watch videos in slow motion and identify when an expression happens. There's a squint or a smirk. Very laborious, extremely expensive, and time-intensive. And so what we do is, again, we use computer vision techniques and machine learning techniques to automate that process so that when a machine, when your computer or your phone sees you smiling, it can recognize that expression or emotion.
But as you point out, Rana, I mean, this is all, the computer is doing this on pixels, not because it knows human faces instinctively like humans do. So, I mean, if something is as subtle as a slight shift in the lighting can make a difference, can't it?
Yes, and this is why there's an art and a science to training these algorithms. First of all, the data, it's a very data-intensive process. And I liken it to pretty much how you, like, would teach a young kid how to identify, you know, different objects, for example. So you have to feed the algorithm tons and tons of examples of people smiling and smirking and frowning. And the more diverse the data, the better the algorithm will be. So if you train it on just, you know, I don't know, like middle-aged white guys, then it's only going to recognize these types of faces, and it will probably fail on somebody like me who has brown-colored skin and is a female, right? So gender diversity, age diversity, ethnic diversity, even things like wearing glasses or wearing facial masks, we've had to go back and retrain the algorithm so that it works when people are wearing these masks, because, you know, we might be in a world where a lot, you know, we'll be wearing them for a while. So these considerations are very important when you're training these algorithms.
Yeah, the whole idea of smiling with your eyes takes on a whole new significance when a lot of people are wearing masks. So, yeah, but let's talk a bit about your own personal journey here, because I imagine you've had a few challenges to having to keep your own emotions in check as a Muslim woman and a person of color in a very heavily white male world of computer science.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born in Cairo and grew up around the Middle East. So I was in Kuwait until the first Iraqi Kuwait Gulf War in 1990, and then my parents moved to the United Arab Emirates, and then I ended up in the UK for my PhD before coming to the United States. So I've been lucky in that I've experienced many cultures, which has certainly influenced my work and my interest in emotions. But I've also been deeply ingrained in these very, you know, gender-specific cultural and societal norms, first by being Middle Eastern, but also, as you said, by being a tech entrepreneur and CEO in a very male-dominated universe. And, you know, I'm a huge advocate for diversity and inclusion. It's something I deeply care about, and I think it's not only, you know, the right thing to do, but I feel like it's a business imperative. You end up with better technologies and better companies if you can bring diverse perspectives to the table. So I advocate for that.
Now, I'm interested in your parents. I mean, they had some very traditional views of the time and place, but they bucked the traditional view of girls and education in particular. What led them that way?
Yeah, so I have two younger sisters. So my parents invested heavily in the education of their three daughters. You know, we grew up with a kind of a set of core values around being hard workers, being very ambitious, very driven. The three of us are extremely driven young women. And, so my parents really prioritized education. In fact, I talk about this in the book. My uncle challenged my dad someday, and he said, you know, why are you investing so much money to educate your daughters? They're just going to grow up and get married and be at home, like, you know, put it in a car or a house. And my dad was very adamant that, you know, that they value, you know, he and my mom valued education, and I am very grateful for that. I feel very lucky and privileged, and I can trace, you know, where I am today all the way back to their investment. It's the best investment they've made in us. And I pay it forward in my kids as well. But at the same time, they were very, you know, they're still very culturally and societally rooted. And, you know, they were very strict. We had very strict curfews. I was not allowed to date until after I graduated college.
Wow.
So it was this interesting tension between, you know, being liberal, but also being conservative.
But yeah, and being a bridge between cultures, and I have to wonder. I mean, obviously, it helps, as you point out. Diversity always helps in a situation like this. But it presents some challenges, I would think, in finding universals in human emotion and its recognition, because expectations are different in different cultures. And then as you point out too, you did at one time wear a hijab, which, as you points out, focuses the attention on the face.
Yeah, I wore the hijab for 12 years, and I put it on by my own, you know, it was my own choice, and when I took it off 12 years later, it was also my own choice, and it just reflected kind of an evolution of my personal and religious, you know, and spiritual beliefs. So I, you know, throughout the whole process, I felt very empowered, but of course, I was challenging, you know, again, I was kind of challenging the cultural norms, by deciding to put it, you know, take it off. But I do want to go back to your kind of question around the universality of all of this. Emotions are fascinating because in one way they are universal, but it's also very nuanced, right? So we know that there are cultural and display norms that depict when people amplify an emotion, but also when they choose to dampen it or mask it altogether. We've all been in all these situations, and we've seen that, you know, collectivist cultures like, you know, East Asia and Southeast Asia, they tend to be less forthcoming about negative emotions, and, you know, you don't see a lot of public anger or criticisms. We see gender differences in how people express emotions. And so it's, I the complexity of it is so fascinating for something that is so personal and to your point, so universal.
There is obviously some trailblazed ahead of you. We're talking to Rana El Khalioubi here on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of the book Girl Decoded: Emotional, A Scientist's Quest to Reclaim Our Humanity by Bringing Emotional Intelligence to Technology. I want to talk about some of the people who blazed some trail ahead of you in the field of emotional intelligence for AI. Talk about Effective Computing, that book.
Yeah, so the book came out in 1996. It came on my radar in 1998. So it's called Affective Computing by an MIT professor called Rosalind Picard. I ordered the book when I was a fresh graduate from computer science at the American University in Cairo, Egypt. It took forever to arrive in Cairo, but I read it and it, you know, it really transformed my life. The book posits that as technology becomes more and more ingrained in our lives, we can't just focus on the IQ of the technology, but we also have to focus on the EQ or the emotional intelligence. And you know, so the book, you know, I found the book very inspiring. It really kind of resonated with my, you know, with my views, and I ended up pivoting my whole research career to focus on that. And ended up meeting Roz later on and, you know, worked in her lab at MIT and co-founded Affectiva with her.
I was about to ask if Affectiva was grown out of the title of that book, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Affective Computing, definitely. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Rana, is there a code of ethics for the work? Because, I mean, emotional recognition is one thing and potentially a good thing, but then there's always the concern about emotional manipulation as the other side of that coin.
Absolutely. And, you know, the applications of this technology are vast. Some applications I feel deeply passionate about. You know, the first example or first application we explored of this technology is for autistic kids. So, you know, individuals on the autism spectrum really struggle with making face contact and eye contact and capturing and understanding all these nonverbal signals. And so we prototyped at MIT a pair of glasses with this technology, and it could give the kids real-time feedback. And we're now partnered with a company that is bringing that to market. So that's very exciting. There's a lot of applications around mental health, like detecting depression and Parkinson's. And even in automotive, we're spending a lot of time at Affectiva focused on driver state monitoring, detecting if drivers are tired or fatigued or drowsy or distracted. So there's a lot of great potential for this technology, but at the same time, you can easily see where it can be abused. For example, in applications where people don't know that they're being monitored, like security or surveillance or lie detection. So when we started the company, we made it our mission to put down some core values around data privacy and consent, and you know, mitigating algorithmic bias to ensure that the technology, to ensure that we can control the unintended consequences of this technology. And we're big advocators of thoughtful regulation around where we can and can't use emotion recognition technology.
We are talking with Rana El-Khalioubi about her book, Girl Decoded, subtitled A Scientist's Quest to Reclaim Our Humanity by Bringing Emotional Intelligence to Technology. You can join the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. As we get back into your personal story just a bit, you and your former husband, Wael, you were apart while you were studying for your PhD at Cambridge, and you got an idea of the failings of computer communication, the things that you were unable to communicate emotionally when you're just dealing with each other electronically.
Yeah, exactly. So that was my first experience kind of living away from home, and I was a young bride. I had just gotten married and got the scholarship, so he had to stay behind for his company, and we had this long-distance relationship. And it hit me that, you know, I was spending way more time in front of my device compared to spending time with other human beings, yet this device had no clue how I was feeling a lot of the times. But even worse, it was the most, you know, it was the main conduit of my communication with you know, Wael, my husband at the time, and the rest of my family back home. And I often felt very lonely and homesick, and sometimes I was even in tears, but all I could do was text and send a little, you know, a small emoji with, you know, the tears and the crying emoji. And it just felt very crude compared to how humans can express, you know, their state. And that's, you know, that really was the impetus for thinking, you know, what if I could fix this? What if we could build technology that has emotional intelligence or that has empathy? And what would that unlock in terms of applications?
Well, yeah, you used the frustration you felt in trying to converse with Wael in presentations. You faced the wall away from the audience. Is that right?
Yeah, I wanted to really bring it home to people how these signals, we often take all of this for granted because we do it automatically, and I wanted to kind of underscore how, what it would feel like if we didn't have it. And so I was giving this presentation to the entire computer science department at Cambridge, and I started it off with my back to the audience, so I faced the wall, and I went on for about a minute, but it felt like forever. And it was so uncomfortable because I couldn't see my audience and the audience couldn't see me, and it's hard. And, you know, and then after the minute I turned around and kind of engaged the audience again. But in a weird way, it mirrors the universe we live in right now. I mean, we're doing this during a global pandemic, and for the most part, a lot of how we're all communicating with our teams and how we're learning and, you know, how we're connecting with our communities and societies, it's all happening virtually. And I've been doing a lot of this for my book tour. I've been doing a lot of virtual book tour events, and I can't see my audience, and it's really painful because I, you know, if it were live, you know, I would riff off the energy of the audience, and I could build on their laughter and all of that, and I find it very unsettling to do this without the audience. But of course, you've been in radio for a long time, so I guess you're a little bit more used to it.
I guess, I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but you're right. I mean, but I'm sitting here thinking about the fact that there's a reason that we call our interactions with computers an interface, because we expect to have a face on the stuff we're dealing with.
Yeah, exactly. We expect some feedback.
So you ended up getting pointed in the direction of exploring autism, and this, you know, certainly makes some sense because we're talking about human beings who can't always read the emotional cues of other human beings. And talk about, if you would, Rana, what Simon Baron Cohen added to the research.
This was again back. You know, I was just starting on this journey at Cambridge University, trying to really figure out how to do this. It's a very complex problem, and I you know, that same presentation where I started with my face to the wall. At the end of it, somebody in the audience said, "You know, you got to look into autism. My brother has autism, and he really struggles with understanding facial clues or cues." So I kind of Googled, you know, autism research, and it turns out one of the top research centers for autism was based at Cambridge University. It was led by Simon Baron Cohen, who is a relative of Sacha Baron Cohen, incidentally, but they're very different characters. And Simon at the time was leading a research effort where he had a database of all of the different facial and vocal expressions humans make, a very diverse data set. It took years to build. And, you know, he took the meeting and I said, you know, my challenge is I'm trying to build a computer that can read these emotions. And he was like, oh, I have this database. Do you want to use it? And it was instrumental to my research because it does take years and a boatload of funding to create this type of data. And he was generous enough to share it with, brand new PhD student. And so that allowed me to leverage that data set to build these algorithms.
Wow. And, so 412 emotions in that database, though. So how did you decide where to start?
Yeah, there was no way I was going to do all 412. Even today, we haven't really figured out how to decode all of them. But I started with a set of states that I thought were relevant to human-computer communication. So, for example, confusion was an interesting one, or interest and comprehension. Agreement, disagreement, joy, surprise, like some of the emotions or the mental states that I thought manifested the most in a human-machine context. And I started with those, and I was able to figure out how to train an algorithm to accurately detect them.
All right, so we have an email here from Cora, no town given. She says, my question is, are facial expressions learned by observation of others while a child is growing up? Do people blind from birth also exhibit the same facial expressions? Thanks from Cora.
That's a great question. I believe there is a lot of research around how infants are born with almost like a, I'm going to use like computer science lingo, with like a chipset with very basic and rudimentary facial tracking and facial expression understanding. But then, of course, as we grow, our taxonomy evolves, right? Like, and I liken the state of the technology to what a toddler can recognize. A toddler can do the basic kind of, happy, sad, mad, right? But as we evolve as humans, our repertoire of emotions becomes really complex, like, you know, expressions of jealousy and pride and wonder. And we haven't really figured out what those emotions look like on the face. This field is very nascent and there's a lot more work to be done. And some of these questions are the things that drive me personally, because I want to figure out.
Sure.
What all these emotions look like.
Yeah, now training an algorithm, as you say, though, to pick up on facial cues is like training a dog, you say. But, I mean, how do you get an algorithm to build on its knowledge, unlike a dog?
Yeah, the answer is in data. We got to keep feeding it more and more diverse data. When we first started, the algorithm was able to only detect like 3 expressions, and now it can do over 25 of these different expressions, and then you can combine them to almost like words in a sentence, right? You've got the letters, and then you can combine it to create a word, and then the words, a sequence of words is a sentence. It's the same way with expressions. You combine these expressions in space and over time to create even more complex emotions.
I could just imagine that the tedium of trying to train your algorithm. It's not just like with kids, you know, this is a happy face, this is a sad face. It's like, this is a happy face, and this is a happy face, and this is a happy face. So, I mean, how long at the algorithm before it could first identify an emotion correctly, Rana?
The key is really in how many examples it would require. And so in our case, you know, a minimum of like tens of thousands of examples of different people smiling and smirking and, to your point, doing, you know, subtle smiles and big smiles and smiles with teeth and smiles that don't have teeth and so on. So when you start to think about it, it's actually a very complex problem. And it took me, you know, the very first time I tried this, it took me over a year and a half to get to the point where the initial algorithm actually worked. But now that we've figured out the secret sauce, if you like, we're able to, once we have the data, we're able to train, new algorithms. So now we're focused on things like drowsiness, you know, and levels of drowsiness. Or attention, or cognitive overload—things that are a little bit more complex.
Mm-hmm. You're getting a lot more subtle as time goes on. Then, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let us take a phone call here. We have Howard in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rana El-Khalioubi. Howard, you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Go ahead.
Yes, I wanted to ask about, you made a reference to glasses that could aid a person with autism in reading other people's facial expressions. And I'm wondering, first of all, what would the cost of this be for parents with children who with autism who need these glasses? Because a lot of these parents with children with autism are not exactly, you know, financially well off to be able to afford to pay for something like that. And second of all, you know, it's like, I don't know if insurance would pay for that, because it would consider something like the like that to be experimental, so it wouldn't qualify for insurance payments, even though the child with autism would actually need them. And the third one, which is basically rhetorical, where were these glasses when I was in elementary school in the early to mid-70s?
Right.
And especially, thank you, Howard. Yeah. Thank you, Howard, for your question. I would like to point you to our partner, BrainPower, and they are using Google Glass and our technology essentially to bring, you know, to bring the device to market, because we're not a hardware company, so we don't make those glasses ourselves. It's basically Google Glass. And I know that they have deployed about 400 of these different families across the U.S. Again, they're, you know, working very hard to bring this to families, and their vision is to definitely bring it at scale and in a way that's affordable.
Checked out the website at brain-power.com. Howard, that's where you'd want to go. And it's just a little bit of a gif that they show here at the beginning about how to train people with autism to recognize cues is really interesting stuff. So they're definitely worth a look. We'll put a link to that at our website, brain-power.com. I want to sidetrack just a bit and ask about you know, here again, your own personal journey, because you were busy having your first baby in the middle of beginning to train your algorithm. So you must have learned some new emotions yourself along the way.
I was a student when I had my first child, my daughter, and I was starting the company when I had my son. He's now 11, and I would drag him along with me when we were raising money from, you know, investors in the Bay Area, and I have a lot of stories around that. But basically, you know, they've always been my guinea pigs, with their consent, of course, but they always test the latest version of the algorithm, and they make sure that it works. And I've learned a lot from them. I've learned a lot around empathy and the importance of empathy in both humans and machines. Very grateful that they have been part of this journey.
But, you know, you point out, too, you're very honest about the things that didn't go completely right in your life. I mean, and you mm-hmm. give the essence of the failure to read emotional cues with Wael leading to the end of that marriage. Obviously you were learning quite a bit about emotions and how they are reflected and generated and all that stuff on the way to trying to get computers to figure this out.
Yeah, it is. It's a little sad and ironic that I was busy kind of really focused on training machines how to read these facial expressions, and I completely missed out that my husband at the time was very unhappy in our marriage, and we were really not, you know, connecting at a deep level, and we had to get a divorce, and I moved with my two kids to Boston full time. At the time, I was commuting back and forth between the U.S. and Cairo. And I learned a lot from that experience. And again, it underscores, you know, exactly where we started, Jeff. It's not just about the technology. It's about humans. And we have to create a bandwidth to listen to all these nonverbal signals, because we often just fixate on the words that are being said. And we miss that parallel conversation with all these nonverbal rich signals.
So let's get the meta here then. I mean, are you accepting the fact that we're going to have a lot of technology around, therefore it we might as well use it to help us with emotions? Or is part of this also to occasionally shove the technology completely aside and just pay attention to the people?
Oh, I would. I'm all for shoving the technology aside, but practically speaking, and, you know, I have two kids at home, and I see how the world is evolving. It's really unrealistic to assume that, you know, in the future we're going to be using less technology. I mean, again, back to where we are today, we've all been catapulted in this universe where everything is virtually conducted. So I think we need to redesign technology in a way that is human-centric, in a way that it considers how we humans connect and communicate with one another. And that's not necessarily how technology is designed today.
Right.
But we can change that.
Yeah, okay, we can. That's why you're here. Let's take another call. Here's Helga in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rana El Kaliubi.
Hi. I am very frightened by what you are suggesting to replace actual human interaction in person. I'm a photographer, and I have spent years and years watching people's expressions, not just the face, but the body. And there are cameras that have such precise timing that you can catch a meaning in an expression. And there's no replacement for the actual being with a person and hearing voice, hearing the tone, seeing the body move. I'm horrified to think that you're trying to put this into the technology rather than admitting that the technology has a limit, and therefore let us make sure that we have the other aspect of being a human too. We're going to create huge mental health crises. We're already feeling that in these 2 months that we've been cut off from each other, the face masks and not seeing expressions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks for the thoughts on that, Helga. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Helga. I'm not at all advocating that we remove, you know, replace human to human connection. Not at all. It's to the contrary. I'm just acknowledging that we live in a world where technology is really at the center, oftentimes around how we connect. And I'm a pragmatist, right? I'm realistic around the role that technology plays and the increasing role that technology plays, and we just need to redesign technology in a way that works for us, not against us.
Now, I was reading just recently, and I'm always 2 months behind in a New Yorker, so it's a March issue, but about the things that people do to defeat facial recognition algorithms, you know, things like putting the makeup on a little off, you know, like not where your eyes actually are and stuff like that. And I just wonder if your algorithms can be defeated in similar ways, or if you've had to do some workarounds in that area.
We're less concerned about facial recognition technologies. You're concerned about identity recognition. Mm-hmm. We're more interested around what expressions are being communicated. There will always be ways to game the system, and again, we're not in the business of lie detection. We are in the business where you want to share your expressions and your emotions. It's just that technology today, you know, doesn't capture it, and then it gets lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to bridge the communication gap.
Now, early in the book, you give us a glimpse of what you hoped the future would deliver, something you flippantly called the Mind Reader 3.0, where you'd walk into your room at home and it would sense your mood and keep the lights a little lower, keep the music a little softer, whatever it is that you needed at that time. So that was your vision of Mind Reader 3.0. And you mentioned at the time you didn't even have a 1.0 version. Where would you say you are today, Rana?
I would say we're like in 1.5, version 1.5, right? We have the core pieces of the technology. We're working very closely with a number of companies to build these in their devices so that the devices can respond in a smart and empathetic way. But look at Amazon Alexa. You know, Alexa doesn't have any EQ at the moment. And so the next version of Alexa or like the next versions of Alexa should really incorporate some notion of emotional intelligence.
So in other words, you'd walk in and say, Alexa, turn the lights on. And Alexa might say, gee, you sound kind of angry. Is everything okay?
Right. Exactly.
This is really what you're trying to move toward.
Yeah, exactly. These conversational agents can, you know, with time, really get a sense of your baseline, and then when you deviate from it, it can detect anger, frustration, maybe even stress and anxiety, and make recommendations. It can say, you know, Jeff, you sound really stressed today, and I'm looking at your calendar, and you've got back-to-back Zoom calls. Like, how about you take a break in the middle of it? How about we schedule this, you know, noon meeting, and you know, free up some of your calendar so you can go for a walk, right? Starts making all these like health and productivity and personal recommendations that help you lead a better life.
And so, is there a product out there yet? I mean, is there something in particular that people would be looking to, well, maybe not now, but in the very near future?
We're in 90 countries already where we measure how people respond to online video content. We're also partnering with car companies to bring this to your car so that if you're distracted or tired while driving, the car can flag that, can alert you, it can take action.
Does it pick up when you're driving angry? Because that's always a major concern.
Yeah, we're working on that. That's the idea too, right? Because that's a form of impairment. If you're angry, you're not really focused. Mm-hmm. So a lot of things in the works, a lot of work to do, but it's exciting.
So you mentioned this a bit already about some of the things that, you know, having to train the algorithm to work around face masks. But what kinds of other things are you learning about human emotions and EQ for AI with the rise of Zoom and all the not in person platforms?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. First and foremost is this, I'm sure you've seen it, Zoom fatigue, right? Like as we spend a lot of hours in front of our devices in these meetings, it's exhausting because, first of all, we're not used to like facing each other continuously for hours, right? So that's kind of really taxing on the brain. But also, I feel like a lot of people just sit there poker faced, and then that really breaks any sense of empathy or synchronicity. And so, I encourage people to exaggerate their nonverbals just a little bit. So, if I say something funny, please do smile. If I say something you agree with, like nod your head, you know what I mean? So to create this connection, which we're all craving, really.
All right. So a little bit of overreaction then, or at least emphasize what the...
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Wow, interesting stuff all around. Truly, it's a really interesting life story, even without the information about what you're doing with emotional intelligence for AI. The book is called Girl Decoded, A Scientist's Quest to Reclaim Our Humanity by Bringing Emotional Intelligence to Technology. It's by Rana El-Khalioubi, our guest today, with writing help from Carol Coleman. Rana, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Day.